I noticed that there's a number of people who were not here yesterday, so just a quick setting the context so that you know what we're doing. We're trying to answer a very important question. When a person becomes a Christian, we expect all kinds of changes to take place in their life. And unfortunately, what we find is that the reality is that those changes either sometimes don't happen much at all, or they don't happen as fast as we would like, or they don't happen as much as we would like. We expect that we're going to become more and more like Jesus. That's what God's goal is for us. But over time, we find that's not what happens. We're still more and more like ourselves. Sorry about that. Here we are. And so we get a little bit disappointed. We get disillusioned, and we're troubled by the fact that we can't make any more progress than what we have made. And so there's any number of Christians that over the years give up because they, you know, they were expecting this Christianity thing to work a whole lot better than it seems to be working. And for those people who are not Christians, they look at our lives and they make judgments about Jesus. They make judgments about the Bible. They make judgments about Christianity based on what they see in us. And so if they don't see much of any change in our lives, they say, you know what, I don't think this Christianity thing works very well, so I don't think I want to have any part of it. So it could be that you've watched a friend, and you look at your friend, and your friend isn't any different than any of the other people that you go to school with, and you think, well, he claims to be a Christian, but he doesn't act any different, so Why should I put any effort into being a Christian if that's all that it's going to produce? Or maybe you've had a parent that's been very difficult, or a child that's been difficult, whatever it is, and these people have claimed to be Christians and you don't feel like they've been a very good example of Jesus. And so you may be tempted to think, you know, I don't have time for this. And so this is a very important question, because our faith depends upon how well we live out this life of Christ that we've been called to live. What I found in my own personal experience is that one of the main reasons why I have struggled with this is because I didn't understand the process that God uses to change people. Unwittingly, I had kind of used the same approach, the same methods that people had used for many years in our society. When we want to change people's behavior, we think, well, we just send them to school and we educate them. And over a period of time, if I can just stuff enough facts in their brain, that gradually they'll change. Well, there's no doubt that we need facts. And the Bible contains all kinds of facts or truths that are important for us to understand. But just knowing those things doesn't change us. In fact, the Bible tells us that knowledge puffs up. In other words, knowledge makes us proud. Doesn't say only incorrect knowledge makes us proud. It says knowledge makes us proud. So I wonder if you've ever known anybody who knows their Bible really, really well, and they're some of the most spiritually unattractive people that you've ever met. They can be very divisive. They can be very ungracious in their manner, but they know the truth. They know their Bibles, because that's what truth does to people when it is not practiced. I'm just stuffing information in their heads. And that's what education does. Well, that's not the way that God works. He does want us to know truth. And He gives us this book that's filled with truth. But He never just leaves it there. He tells us how to make use of it. And that's where I think a lot of this change breaks down, because we don't know how to put this truth into action in our lives. And so that's what we've been trying to look at here, is how God goes about doing that. So we've looked at two things. First, we started off talking about what God's goal is for us, that He wants to make us like Jesus. Can you imagine what a person you would be if you would be like Jesus? But we also saw in the next session after that that there's a problem. There's something that's in the way. There's a barrier, a wall that's built up that I can't get across. I want to get to be like Jesus, but I can't get there because sin is in the way. Well, I think, okay, well, if I can just kind of change my sinful behavior, then I can become more like Jesus. But what we discover is that the more I try to get beyond that over that wall, I can't do it. And so what we found is that sin is not just behavior choices that we make. We find that sin actually makes us into slaves. And so I have no choice. The reason why I do the bad things that I do isn't because I'm choosing to do them. It's because there is this power inside of me called sin that is ordering me to do these things. And so remember, we saw the picture of that lady. She was a heroin addict. And we saw, even after that, the picture of all the ingredients of methamphetamine, the Drano, the lye, the muriatic acid, battery acid, that they mix all together and they turn into this stuff called meth. Why would people put that in their system? Nobody in their right mind would do that. But sin tells us to do that. That's why people do it. Okay? And we could run that out across any number of other examples in life as well. But we're going to turn the corner. I left you last night on the edge of your seats because I left you with all the bad news about what sin was. And, you know, it made you wait until this morning to find out what the good news is. And so that's what we're going to pick up with this morning. But in order to kind of frame what we're going to talk about this morning, I need to introduce you to some history. I love history. I hope you love history. My son does not like history, so I'm still working on him. This is, as you can see, the South Fork Dam. This is actually located in northwestern Pennsylvania. Northwestern Pennsylvania is a very hilly, mountainous area. And you see this dam. This is an artist's drawing that was done back in the 1850s, picturing what that dam looked like at that point in time. You know, the dam was about 900 feet long. It was about 70 feet high. It looks like it's all made out of rock, but actually it's an earth dam. It's built out of dirt that is faced and mixed with rock. It's not concrete. If you've ever seen like the Hoover Dam or any pictures of that, you know, you have these very thick, reinforced concrete barriers that hold the water back. It's very strong. Well, that's not what this is. This is an earthen dam. And so it wasn't as big as Hoover Dam, so it didn't have to hold back as much water. But the fact of the matter is that all the streams from those mountain areas would flow down into the South Fork Creek. And it would accumulate. And so over a period of years, a lake developed behind this dam. And eventually there was so much water that the lake was 2 miles long and a mile wide. So just imagine how much water is in this lake. And so over a period of time, the land where this dam was located transferred ownership a couple of times. Different people would buy it and sell it and buy it and sell it. And the problem was is that nobody wanted to spend money fixing up the dam. Well, if you've got an earthen dam, you can't let it go unmaintained. You've got to maintain it. Well, nobody wanted to do that. So they would just kind of put some Band-Aid solutions on it. If there were leaks that would spring out, they would just kind of do the bare minimum just to get by. Well, in 1889, it was on the night of May 30th, 1889, that there was a massive storm that flowed through this area of western Pennsylvania. And in a period of 24 hours, it dumped 10 inches of rain. And all those creeks that fed down into this South Fork Creek and had now become a lake, they just continued to cause the water level to rise and to higher and higher and higher until they knew that it was going to eventually top over the dam and start running over. And so the workers were rushing to try to repair as many of the leaks as they could and strengthen the dam as best they could, but eventually it became evident that they weren't going to be able to save the dam. They knew that this dam was going to break. And so the supervisor of the team, he tried to send a message downstream. Now on the other side of this dam, as we're going to see, it's still just a little creek. Not a big river, it's just a little creek that flows down through these gorges and canyons. Because in that area of Pennsylvania, the mountains, you know, form very steep sides. And so the valleys are very narrow and very steep. And as you go down through there, there were a series of towns downstream. And so they were connected by telegraph wires. They didn't have telephone, they didn't have internet, but they used telegraph. And so he went to try to send messages to the residents downstream, but unfortunately, in the storm, all of the telegraph poles had toppled over and the lines were broken, and so he was not able to send the message. So he did the only other thing that he had left available to him to do, is he sent a train down. There was a train track that went along the side of the stream at the bottom of in the valley portion of these mountains. And he sent it down as fast as he could, but you know, these things can only go so fast. And the engineer was going down, blowing his horn and sending signals out. Nobody had any idea what he was trying to signal them about, but he was trying to warn them that the dam was about to break. Well, at 3 o'clock in the afternoon on May 31st, the dam burst. They estimate that there was 20 million tons of water that spread out into the valley below. Those people who were up higher up and saw the water that was unleashed kind of roar down through the canyons there, they estimated that there was a wall of water about 40 feet high. That's how steep the canyon walls were. And as it was going along, it would just pick up everything in its path. All the trees, any buildings that it came across, everything was completely obliterated, and it would accumulate all of this debris. It got so bad that as it progressed down through the valley, you couldn't even tell that there was water. All it was just logs and cows and barns and houses and all this stuff all kind of knotted up together, just moving down the valley in this seething mass. And there was this unearthly roar. It was so loud. At one point, they estimate that it was going about 40 miles an hour. So there was no way that you could outrun this thing. Well, as I said, it destroyed everything in its path. And unfortunately, because there was no way to warn the residents downstream in time, they really had only just a couple of minutes of warning. They could hear the roaring. They could hear the train whistle blowing. They didn't know what was going on. And as best they could, they saw the mass of stuff coming down through the valley. They tried to make it up to the sides. Some made it, but many of them did not. Some of you know the story of the Johnstown flood. This is Johnstown. That's what they're talking about here. By the time it was done, this was a city of 30,000 people. 2,200 of them were wiped out in just a matter of a few minutes. Okay, now imagine what a national tragedy that was. If you think back to 9/11, we lost, 3,000 some people in a matter of minutes, and what that did to our nation. This is no different. We had a much smaller population of people, and to lose 2,000 people like that just in a matter of minutes, what a national tragedy that was. Well, you can see what it did. Look at it. It's just scoured everything clean. There's nothing left. How these buildings survived, I have no idea, but it just wiped everything completely clean. Why do I start off with an illustration like this? Because in many ways, like we had discussed in our last session, we are all in the path of God's wrath. This verse here in Romans chapter 1, it says, "The wrath of God is being revealed from heaven against all the godlessness and wickedness of men who suppress the truth by their wickedness." This next verse, "But because of your stubbornness and your unrepentant heart, you are storing up wrath against yourself for the day of God's wrath when His righteous judgment will be revealed." That phrase in the yellow there, "you are storing up wrath against yourself," that makes me think of that dam. Remember how I described it? As the rain came down and accumulated all that water behind that dam, building up all of that pressure until eventually the moment came when the dam couldn't hold it back anymore and all that water burst forth. God's wrath really is the same way. The dam that holds it back is God's mercy. It's not that God hates us. God doesn't hate us. But He hates all the things that hurt His people. And He is opposed to people who hurt other people. That's the Romans 1 type of person who maliciously is out there trying to do harm to other people because they're so enslaved and so devoted to sin. God is angry, and we looked at that, how angry God gets at sin. Why? Because it's done so much damage to His world and so much damage to His people. Who can blame Him? Really, in this respect, God's anger is a measure of God's love. If anybody tried to harm my children, I would be angry. I wouldn't just say, "Oh, well, that's fine. I forgive you." And you know, I'd like to be able to say that I would be very patient and kind and loving towards somebody who harmed my children. But I know that I would struggle with great anger. Why? Because I love my children. And so my anger at someone who tries to harm my children is a measure, in many ways, of my love for my children. And the same thing is true with God. So He has limitless love. So He also has limitless anger as well. And so that anger, building up, day after day, with each accumulated sin, with each accumulated sorrow, with each accumulated pain that we find in our lives, God's anger at this just growing and growing, and God's mercy straining to hold it back. But there will come a day, it's not that God's mercy wears out, but there comes a day when God just says, you know what, I'm not going to hold it back anymore. And He lets it go. That day is coming. And the problem is that we are like the people of Johnstown. We are downstream. And we are in the path of the wrath. Now the good news, the difference between us and the people of Johnstown, is that we have warning. They did not have warning. We have warning. I'm warning you. If no one else has warned you, I've warned you just now. Okay? So the question then that we want to talk about as we're switching gears is, if you know that you are in the path of God's wrath like this, what do you need? You need somebody to save you, to get you out of harm's way. That's what you need. And so that's what we're going to talk about. What God has done to deliver us, to save us from the destruction that is coming down upon us. The fact is, we need a Savior. But the question I want you to think about is, what kind of a Savior do you need? Quite simply, you have to just picture it this way, that the nature of the problem that you're dealing with determines the kind of Savior that you need. So for example, we have a popular assumption. We talked about this yesterday. The popular assumption is that we view sin as a behavior. Anytime that I do something that doesn't make God happy or that breaks one of God's commands, that's a sin. Well, yes, in a broad sense, that's true. We'll talk about this more in just a minute, just to kind of to review some of this. But let's follow this through. If you view sin as simply a behavior, a choice that you make to do the wrong thing, then the solution that you have is to change your behavior. So the question is, if that's the problem, and that's what my need is, to change my behavior, what kind of a Savior then do I need? What I need is a Savior who can help us change our behavior. Well, what kind of Savior can do that? Well, this kind of Savior is more like a personal trainer. All right, so imagine you've got your own personal trainer. This person who inspires you to, you know, get up in the morning and do your exercises and eat the right kind of food and take care of yourself, and maybe even kind of gets on your case from time to time, and then encourages you at other times and gets on your case at other times, and kind of walks you through all of the different techniques and the different diet plans that you need to have in order to get yourself healthy and strong and ready to go. This is the kind of Savior that you need if this is what your problem is. All you need is a personal trainer. Okay? The problem is that our issue goes much deeper, as we saw, than just a surface behavior issue. It's not just that I'm making the wrong choices. Our problem is that we are hopelessly enslaved to a power that is far greater than we can handle. I can't change because my master's sin won't allow me to change. Remember how we saw that? Every slave master that's worth his salt doesn't just enslave his slaves. He also has to kind of build up a defense to make sure that his slaves don't escape. Remember, slaves never serve willingly. They're always unwilling, always looking for ways to escape their master. And so a good master has to find ways to keep his slaves from escaping. And the most effective way to do that isn't to just to build a fence, because you can't build a fence that's big enough or strong enough. Eventually they're going to get over it or cut through it or whatever. What you do is you rob them of the desire to even escape. You so demoralize them so discourage them that they won't even try. And that's what sin does. And that's why we saw these things. This is kind of just review. How it is that sin keeps us enslaved. Remember, he puts us to death. And we saw some verses that talk about that, that we're dead in sins, as it says in Ephesians chapter 2. Well, you know, if you're dead, how much escaping can you do? You can't do it. Dead people don't escape. Dead people can't do anything. They don't have any strength to do it. Sin also deceives us. It tricks us into thinking that we have more ability to beat sin than we really do. The next thing is that sin hardens us. Remember, it makes us insensitive. So here is God. He's trying to speak truth into our lives. He's trying to show His love to us. He's trying to help us out. But we're so hardened that we're insensitive to anything that God's doing. I can't discern truth. Have you ever talked to somebody, their life is obviously completely screwed up, and you're trying to help them see how their choices are harming their life, and you can't get them to see it? Why? Because they're deceived and because they're hardened. It's not just because they're stubborn. Well, they may be that too, but that's not the whole issue. They're hardened. They can't understand the truth. Sin takes your mind and so pollutes it that you can't recognize truth when you see it. I look at stuff in the press even now, in the news, and I just think, how can people honestly believe that some of this stuff makes any sense? But that's the effect of sin. It happens to individuals, it happens to a society. The last thing it does is that sin separates us from God by doing what? It inoculates us. Remember that big word. You're going to give a person a shot so that they're not going to get sick from like the flu, for example. You get a flu shot, so you keep them from getting sick. Well, sin does that with God. It turns us against God. It kind of whispers in our ear, don't trust God, because God's going to rob you of all the joy in your life. He's going to take out all the fun. If you do all the stuff that it says in the Bible, you're not going to have any fun left. So don't listen to him. And don't listen to any of his people, because they're all wrong. They're all lying to you. All they want is your money. And we believe it. And that's why we're enemies of God. Well, ultimately, sin's plan was to make us so repulsive to God that God would have no choice but to destroy us. That was His plan, if I can term it that way. And we remember, we're looking at sin as a person. We know that sin is not a person, but the Bible in Romans chapter 6 kind of describes sin as a slave master. So we're just kind of following that through. So sin has succeeded in placing us under God's wrath. We have broken God's law. We have offended Him. Remember, we killed His Son. Our sin made it necessary for His Son to die. We rejected and murdered His Son. We scorned all of His attempts to save us. And so on the surface, it would appear that Master Sin has succeeded in his plot to not only divide us from God, but to destroy us. And he's going to put it in position where sin doesn't have to do the destroying, that God's going to destroy us in His judgment. What a diabolical plot that is. But there's a weakness in sin's plan. And here it is. The weakness in sin's plan is that he has underestimated his enemy. Remember we saw that last time? The danger of underestimating your enemy? You'll overestimate your ability to deal with your enemy. Well, isn't that ironic that sin did the same thing? We do that with sin. We underestimate the power of sin, and so we keep falling into more and more sin because we think that we can manage it, and we can't. Well, sin does the same thing. Sin underestimates his enemy. Not only that, sin assumes, if I can say so, that the distance between us and God is too great. He believes that our offense is so final that there is no hope that we'll ever be able to get back on God's good side. We are bound to our sin. God is bound to His justice. And so we're doomed. That was his plan. That distance was too great. The offense that we had committed against God by murdering his son was too great. And Master Sin did not count on the fact that despite all that we had done against him, that God would still love us. Didn't count on that. He did not count on the fact that there was a way that God could rescue us without violating his justice. He assumed that God had no choice but to destroy us in judgment. But he didn't realize that there was another way. If you've seen the Narnia, the first Narnia, the Lion, the Witch in the Wardrobe, there's a scene in there where they talk about there's this deeper magic, right? And the witch, she didn't know about it. She didn't realize that there was this deeper mystery of truth and reality in the world by which Aslan, the lion, was going to be able to rescue the people of Narnia. Well, it's the same way. That's C.S. Lewis's illustration of this. There was always this mystery, known to God, but unknown to everyone else. And Satan, with all of his smarts and intelligence and craft, he did not figure it out. He did not understand what this plan was. So, if slavery to sin is our problem, remember what we said before, if my problem is just behavior, that's one kind of savior. But if my problem is that I am a slave to sin, what kind of a savior do I need? Well, let's just be real simple. I need a savior who can free me from slavery. And not only that, when I understand how a slave master works to keep his slaves under control, I need a savior who can get past all of sin's defenses. And what are those defenses? Death, deception, hardness of heart, and the fact that we have been made enemies in our minds towards God. I have to have a Savior who can deal with all of those things. If there is death, I need one who can give life. If there is deception, then I need one who can speak truth. And not just speak truth, but get me to accept the truth. That's the challenge. Not just if I'm hardened, I need someone who can soften me so that I won't resist it anymore. If I'm an enemy towards God, then I need a Savior who can find a way to make me friends with God once again. That's the kind of Savior that I need. We need a Savior who can save us from God's wrath. Remember, that still is building up. And we're still in the path of the wrath, and it's waiting for that dam to burst one day in the future. So I need a Savior who can save me from all of that. The fact of the matter is, there is only one way to escape the grip of sin. Only one way. We talked about this a little bit yesterday. If I was a slave and I wanted to escape these miserable conditions that I'm living in, and wherever it happens to be, you have several options. Remember, we said you can overpower the slave master. You can knock him on the head and run. Or you can kill him. Or you can try to escape by sneaking out at night and running away. And certainly many people were able to do that. But unfortunately, none of these options is available to us. We can't overpower sin. It's too strong for us. I can't run away from sin. Why? Because sin is not outside me. Sin is inside me. It's my nature. It's who I am. So wherever I run, it's like trying to run away from my shadow. I got a shadow right here. I can't leave my shadow. Wherever I go, it goes with me. And so sin is the same way. I can't run away far enough or fast enough. There's only one way to escape. You ready? Here it is. You got to die. Bummer. What's the problem with this solution? Well, the great news is that if I die, I'm free. How much work can a slave master get out of a dead slave? Not much. Not much. You can assign him all kinds of chores, and he won't move. He's free. The dead slave is free from the control of the master. He doesn't have to do what the master tells him to do anymore. It's a glorious day. What's the problem? He's dead. He can't do anything else either. Okay, life is over with. What good is that? What kind of a solution is that? Well, this is all a part of God's plan. This is what sin, this is sin's basic miscalculation, because sin assumed that this was going to be the end. Sin did not calculate, Satan did not calculate that there was a possibility that there was another way to accomplish this. Okay? So God also knows that this is true, and that's why God provided a different kind of a Savior. Now, look at this verse here. Romans chapter 5. You see, at just the right time, when we were still powerless, remember there's that language, we're under the power of sin. When we're still powerless, Christ died for the ungodly. Very rarely will anyone die for a righteous man, though for a good man someone might possibly dare to die. But God demonstrates His own love for us in this: while we were still sinners, Christ died for us. Now I want to ask you something. What good is a dead Savior? I'm the one who has to die.